Welcome to the Sports Science Dudes. I'm your host, Dr. Jose Antonio, with my co-host. Well, normally it's Tony Ricci, but filling in for me is my doctoral student, Cassie Evans.
Hi.
So she was the last minute. She's like the backup quarterback when the other quarterback gets hurt. So it's good to have her here. Now, if you're a first time listener, hit the subscribe button and like the show. We're on YouTube, Rumble, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Our special guest today, I spent most of my morning trying to pronounce her name, is Dr. Shiloa, or Shy, as her friends call it. And I'm going to see if I don't butcher her last name. Kvyatkovsky. Shy, say your last name.
Shiloa Kvyatkovsky.
Okay, that doesn't sound like anything I've ever said. All right, well, thanks for filling in and pronouncing your last name. Shy, as her friends call her. She's a postdoc at University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences Center for Translational Research and Aging and Activity. I've always wondered why I have to say all the names, and you can't just say you're a postdoc at Arkansas. You're working with Dr. Arnie Ferrando, by the way, so that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
You got your PhD at Florida State University working with Mike Ormsby, researching the effects of collagen peptide supplementation on pain, function, and connective tissue turnover in middle-aged, lifelong athletes, and I know we have a lot of questions about that. Prior to that, actually, you have an interesting background. You research human performance and blast injury in U.S. Navy Special Operations warfighters. That's pretty cool. You have dual grad degrees in exercise physiology and nutrition from San Diego State University, which, by the way, is a very pretty campus. I love that campus. Too bad California costs so damn much, but it is gorgeous there. She's also a certified tactical strength and conditioning facilitator through the NSCA, certified sports nutritionist through the ISSM, and her current research focuses on connective tissue turnover and protein kinetics in active and aging populations, and is actively studying the efficacy of collagen peptide supplementation on bone, joint, and health. So I'm not even going to try to butcher your name. We're just going to call you Shy from now on. Dr. Shy, welcome to the Sports Science Dudes, although it's only one dude here, two dudettes. Thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks for having me. Yeah, the estrogen is taking over today.
God forbid. Let me ask you this. So you are in Arkansas, which is like, if I were to list states that I would want to go do stuff in, it would like be in the bottom like three. However, you were there. Dr. Arnie Ferrando somehow reeled you in. So describe your postdoc experience at the University of Arkansas Medical Sciences.
All right. Well, for one, Arkansas is a hidden gem. I would have never thought that
I would. Did you say hidden gem?
I did.
Oh, my God.
You're not in the middle of nowhere then.
It is. And I mean, this is, I think, it's the natural state. So, I mean, they have diamonds and they call this the gem state. So it is not, it's a small, like big city here. It's much like Tallahassee, but with way more outdoor activities to do. So, I mean, I live on the river. I can go stand up paddleboarding on the river.
Get out of here.
Outside of my balcony. There is like world-class mountain biking here. I mountain biked in Florida and I went on advanced trails there, and the beginner trails here are like the advanced trails in Florida. So
I believe that. Yeah.
Lots of road biking. This place has an insane tennis community. So I literally just play tennis every single day. So that's outside of my postdoc, obviously, but my postdoc experience here has been great. I've been introduced to the orthopedic surgeon team here, and I've been working with the knee joint replacement surgeons, collecting tissue, specifically ACL tissue out of TKA surgeries. And I've been actually getting healthy samples from organ donors also. So doing some of my postdoc research on proteomic analyses of ACLs from healthy versus OA patients who are getting total knee replacements. And then that's going to transition into a very exciting new collagen peptide study. With Arnie, we're doing a lot of protein metabolism research, especially throughout the menopause transition in females. So looking at muscle and how muscle protein synthesis happens with meat versus non-meat substitutes. So we've been doing some of that with isotope tracers using deuterium. writing lots of papers. I'm over here with David Church also. So lots of collaboration with him and lots of joking around. Katie Hirsch was here for a couple months. We had some overlap. So that was really good last summer. She took me on a lot of hikes and showed me around. So we've been kind of doing research and then playing a lot. So
wow, it is quite a hidden gem. I think Cassie's ready to move. Look at her.
Well, you want to go? Like, is it as hot as it is down here this summer? Because you know that this heat's about ready to make me move.
Well, you know, the one thing about here is everybody complains about the humidity, but coming from Florida, I just kind of laugh and I check and I'm like, it's like 58% humidity here. I was like, guys, you got to understand that this is not humid. It's just hot, like right. Straight hot. Yeah, it does get a little hot here and toasty, but it's definitely different than being in Florida because it's not as steamy. So definitely way more capable of doing things outside all year round here. But we also have winter. But it's nice and it snows a little bit. So
yeah, see that alone, winter. I'm like, okay, forget it. It's either South Florida, South Texas, or Arizona for me. After that, I can't live anywhere else. So,
and I don't know. I don't understand cold. Like anything below like 60 is just cold. It's all cold to me. Like I don't understand. Like, when we go back up north for like the holidays, and I'm like, okay, so it's like snowing, but how? I don't know what to pack. I just know I'm freezing.
You figure it out, and then if you have like snow sports that you can do, if there's snow, then that kind of makes up for it. So, I mean, I was a big time snowboarder and surfer when I was in San Diego, so it was kind of like, yes, let's find things to do. But I don't know, being in Tallahassee in North Florida, it was cold and it was really humid, so it made my joints hurt and I felt like I was cold all day, and then there was nothing I could do outside that was playful with the weather, so it kind of negated any kind of fun there. So
yeah, I don't think of Tallahassee as a place to snowboard or surf.
No. No, I would wait for hurricanes and then drive 3 hours out to either coast and then you know, cross my fingers that there was something fun happening. So
How long is your postdoc?
I am currently applying for assistant professor positions. So it'll be over when I find a new position to transition to, hopefully here. So
okay. So the total postdoc time would be roughly 2 years?
Yeah, maximum, I think, is what I'm allowing.
Are you applying everywhere or just a few places?
I'm just starting to look. I've been mainly applying here and trying to stay here internally because I do have a lot of really exciting research that's about to start and come through, and I have some funding coming through. So, but as backup plans, yeah, I'll start probably applying all over.
Really? Well, good luck with that.
Thank you.
Now let's get back to the topic of collagen, because I know you just had a paper accepted. I don't think it's in print yet. Is it?
Not yet.
Okay, the 6 and 9 month collagen study. And I just want to tell the audience ahead of time that anyone who attempts to do a 9 month study in RCT, you're either a masochist or a little crazy. Because I would imagine, and this was this at Florida State?
It was, yeah.
I would imagine Mike Ormsby would have said, you know, this is a lot harder than you think it is. It's not technically a 9 month study. I think it ends up being what, a 3 or 4 year study?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It was the entire duration of my PhD. There's a funny story because he's actually the one that handed me that protocol. He was like,
oh,
go.
I know,
tell us the story.
Like, how did you get people to stay in the study long enough?
I mean, there are so many jokes. So number one, it started as a 6 month study. And when I talked to Mike about doing my PhD there, I had a lot of experience. So I did work in blast injury, but I also spent before that, I spent 3 years working with the Navy, setting EOD populations and doing human performance research with them. So I had about 4 years of really solid research experience before I went back to my PhD. And so Mike had just gotten some funding from this collagen company in Belgium, and he had kind of like a rudimentary protocol. And he felt that I had enough experience that he could just kind of let me take over as I started my PhD program and did all my classes, and it worked out really well. But we did decide that with an additional grant from the company, that since we were assessing bone markers also, that we should try to tack on an extra 3 month arm for whoever completed the initial 6 months successfully. We asked them if they would be willing to stay for another 3 months. So we did end up extending it. And So from a total of 86 people that we recruited for 6 months, we ended up being able to retain about 54 people, I think, for the additional 3 month arm. And we saw them every single month. I mean, it was really like I had a team of grad students. They had a team of undergraduate students. We had interns. And then myself, obviously. And so we kept in constant contact with all these people. I mean, but it was like a constant, like, you know, conveyor belt of like people coming in for assessments at 5 a.m. and 5 p.m. every single month, you know, checking in on them and making sure that they're kind of adhering to supplementation, that they're filling out their food frequency logs, that, you know, they weren't having issues with any of the supplements, that they were happy to stay. And a lot of them were, you know, adamant about not staying on at the 6 month point. And then we just kind of, you know, gave them some incentives, like a little bit more money. How about 1 year free supply of collagen if you stay on? And so, you know, and then I had a little, you know, talk with them about how important they were to the study. And so, you know, just really a lot of positive reinforcement. And that's how you keep people on. But you have to really communicate with them constantly to get them to stick through it. So yeah, but really good team and really good people working with you and making sure everybody's on top of it. It's the only way to keep people involved.
So you have this, you're basically ended an enormous project.
Yeah.
And I know most people would view, I mean, just even if you read that a study's 9 months, you're like, wow, that's going to take a while. But because you're juggling all these people at different time points, there must have been a point in your doctoral student career where you asked yourself, why did I choose this project again?
I definitely did, especially when I was also teaching at the same time and, you know, flying back home to California every month to see my child. And yeah, I was like, what is happening? Why am I doing this collagen study? But I took collagen for a really long time. I've been an athlete, a recreational athlete, my entire adult life. And I had a lot of pain chronically. And so I would always kind of go on it and then go off of it to see if it, you know, made a difference. And in my opinion, personally, I thought that I felt better when I was on it. And so I kind of thought it was a little serendipitous for me to be handed a collagen study when I walked through Mike's lab door. And I'm glad I did, because I've had a lot of anecdotal kind of feedback from people, because a lot of the people that were in that study, I mean, they were recreational athletes and legitimate, like triathletes, master's level CrossFit athletes. And once they found out which group they were in and they were offered, you know, a free 1 year supply of the actual supplement, if they were in a placebo group, they came back and told me that they felt differences. So, I don't know, I felt that the work was important and it was a really great study and it was a good learning experience for myself, but also all of the students involved. A lot of the grad students have now gone on to their PhDs. And, you know, so it's, I think, really helped to propel them forward in research too.
Okay. Tell the audience. So you had a placebo, a 10 gram, I think, in a 20 gram group.
Correct.
And so you had a 6 month and 9 month time point. What were the assessments that you made? And I know I had a question. In fact, I talked to Mike Ormsby about this, about how it seemed like the lower dose worked better than the higher dose, which I don't know anything about collagen, but I thought, well, it's protein. Why would 20 grams not work as well as 10 grams? So explain the assessments you did and, you know, the outcomes at 6 months and 9 months.
Sure. So we did a lot of surveys, which they did fill out once a month. So they did the COOS, which is the knee osteoarthritis outcome score. They did a veterans RAND. It looks at mental component scores of quality of life and physical component scores of life. We did some visual analog scales. We didn't see very much in those. We assessed range of motion. We did DEXA for body composition, bone mineral density in both hips and the lumbar spine. And then we took blood. And so we did DEXA and blood at, I think, baseline 3 months, 6 months, and 9 months to look at some of the turnover biomarkers and inflammation. And so we ended up seeing significant improvements in that 10 gram a day group in two of the subscales of the COOS, and then in the mental component scores for the veterans RAND, which is really exciting because nobody's ever seen anything with respect to, you know, like cognitive or like mood function with collagen peptides, but they have seen animal studies have seen similar results though, which is really interesting because, and it really has, it relies heavily on the composition of the bioactive peptides. So these di and tripeptides that are found in, in the collagen peptide formulation, depending on how they're hydrolyzed. And then, so we did see improvements in physical function in that 10 gram a day group. And then interestingly, we saw reductions in pain in people who were more active. So I ended up dichotomizing or splitting in half lower 50% and upper 50% of people by how many minutes per week were they doing low to moderate intensity exercise. And so the people that were in the lower 50% didn't see improvements in pain, but the people that were in the higher 50% did. And that makes sense because if you think about it, all the connective tissue is kind of poorly vascularized. It doesn't get a whole lot of blood flow. So if you're going to consume collagen and you need those peptides to get to the places where you're having inflammation and you have some kind of, you know, micro tears or injuries, getting increased blood flow to those areas is now going to deliver the peptides there. And so these people saw decreases in pain with that 10 gram a day group. And so we asked why. Why would you see something with 10 grams and not 20 grams? Well, I think remember that dose makes the medicine or the poison in our body, right? And so I think that there is probably kind of like a bell-shaped curve with, kind of like a plateau and a rate of diminishing returns potentially. Arnie thinks that has to do with the glycine also, that there might be a shuttle to the ammonia cycles, but we haven't really been able to test it. So we just kind of need to look at that maybe in the future. But we do know from the literature that lower doses seem to be more effective and kind of higher doses, depending on what you're looking at, either just kind of stop doing anything, or in some of the animal studies, you just lose the effect completely. So it just depends on how high that is.
And are you suggesting because you mentioned that there's a difference in mood. So are you suggesting that the collagen actually is what's responsible for the mood, or is it the decrease in pain that they're reporting that makes them feel better? Because now they're not experiencing pain. They can probably enjoy exercise more. I would assume that that's going to make people a lot happier as well.
So that is the question. That's precisely what I asked myself also. And so that's something that we need to investigate a little bit more. There are a couple animal studies that looked at a couple of the specific bioactive peptides, and they saw that hydroxyproline and proline are able to actually cross the blood-brain barrier. And they saw that there were positive effects on dopamine and some other neurotransmitters. And I don't know specifically what the composition is of the peptides in the supplement that we tested, so I can't speak to that, but I know that other bioactive peptides do not cross that blood-brain barrier. So I think it's important to know what the formulation looks like from that standpoint, but it is a little bit difficult to measure, and the company has to be willing to measure it also, or at least report it. So the question is, yes, is it because you had less pain and you're able to be more active again? Or is it because there was an increased effect somehow on something in your brain that made you feel better? So that's a great question. Exactly. Yeah.
Were there any body comp changes in the collagen peptide groups?
No. So that was one thing. It hasn't been reported yet. That's going to come up in another paper that I'm working on right now with some of the biomarker stuff. So we did see changes in some of the markers of connective tissue turnover also that is being written up currently. And one thing that's interesting is that I think previously synthesis has always been kind of what everyone has focused on, especially with, you know, bone and muscle and also connective tissue. But when you start looking at some of the newer research with connective tissue, you're starting to think about synthesis. And then also you have to look at breakdown, because if breakdown is not keeping up with synthesis, then you end up with fibrotic tissue and then it becomes stiff and it's dysfunctional. And so when it comes to connective tissue, I'm actually focusing on measuring breakdown as opposed to really focusing on synthesis, because with age, we're getting more fibrotic tissue that is less functional. And so we actually saw an increase in some of the markers of connective tissue degradation, which I think corresponds to potentially breakdown of damaged tissue so that new tissue can be laid down. So that's some of the new stuff coming up. But with body comp, I mean, there was no exercise intervention. Everybody was really variable in the types of activities that they were doing. So unless they're doing some kind of specific exercise, like resistance training routine, I wouldn't expect to see anything.
Yeah, I was thinking specifically bone mineral density or their T score or Z score. That didn't change at all. And
No. And I think our, again, it was a little variable. It was 40 to 65 year olds. Some were osteopenic, osteoporotic, some were not. There was a 50-50 split on males and females. 50% of the females were postmenopausal. So I think the length of the study, as well as the variability in our study population, would have limited our ability to see anything in bone. I definitely think there is one study that looked at postmenopausal females that had either osteopenia or osteoporosis. They supplemented with 5 grams a day for 12 months and they did see some results. So I think that that study needs to be replicated for sure.
So would the lowest possible or lowest dose that would be beneficial be 5 grams?
What would you know? I mean, I think it depends on what kind of results that you want. And I think it depends on the formulation. And I think that I think some of the companies outside of the United States are focusing on that a lot more. And I think that maybe some of the collagen research is starting to actually catch up and admit that that is a major component of it, that it's the source and the composition and the way that it's hydrolyzed. And depending on what kind of bioactive peptides, what's the mechanism of action and what type of, what area of the body is that supplement going to target more? And then I think that the dose is going to be very dependent on that itself.
Aside from like the dose, you mentioned like the type of peptides that are in there can make a difference. And then is there, I guess, the form, whether it's a pill or a powder, if you're consuming it with food or not, that affects its bioavailability?
I don't know about that. I know that the type 2 collagen supplements generally come in smaller doses and they come in capsules usually. The type 1 usually, and 1 and 3 is usually combined together. That usually comes in a powdered form. I don't know if the form of it actually matters. I do know that there have been a limited amount of studies that have looked at combining milk protein with collagen and seeing increased effects. And it could have something to do with some of those bioactive peptides that are also found in milk protein too. And I've had some conversations with people that are in the whey industry about this. And so we definitely think that we need to do some combo studies coming up as well. Well, not just because of that, but also because collagen does not, I always have to tell this, and then let me get the elephant out of the room first is, you know, everybody's like, well, collagen is a protein and whey is a protein. You know, I always tell people do not supplement do not replace, you know, whey with collagen with whey or vice versa. Like, I think that they should be used together because one has everything you need for your muscle, essential amino acids. The other one is like for something totally different. So, but other foods, I don't know if there is any kind of impact aside from making sure that you have adequate vitamin C status also when you're consuming the collagen. So,
yeah, when you look at the, I guess, the joint support space in the supplement industry, the two supplements that are pretty much, I guess they've been pretty much around for the last few decades are chondroitin sulfate and glucosamine. I actually take glucosamine. I've probably been taking it for 20 years, to be honest. I don't know if it does anything, but my joints seem fine. So I don't know if it's because I do non-impact stuff, or maybe I'm just, you know, genetically gifted and have no joint pain. How, Cassie's like, yeah, that's funny. When you look at the category, how would collagen protein rank in terms of efficacy compared to glucosamine or chondroitin sulfate or some combination thereof? Or is there some sweet spot where if you combine them all, maybe that's better than each of them, you know, singularly?
More is better.
Not always. Remember, rate of diminishing returns. I'm not as familiar with the chondroitin and glucosamine space. I do have a visual of a graph that I saw not too long ago about them kind of plateauing with research and popularity and collagen kind of skyrocketing. And so that's just some market data.
Yeah.
I don't know about the research and I don't know if anybody's looked at them together. I haven't seen anything. I would say, I think it seems that collagen is kind of taking off in that space. And from the literature that I'm seeing, especially with osteoarthritis and things like that, and especially after joint injuries, that collagen seems to have a decent amount of efficacy, especially when it's combined with some type of rehabilitative exercise program. Again, you need to have, you know, force to stimulate that turnover in there, and then also the increased blood flow. It would be interesting to see if somebody combined all three to see how that is working out. And then whether or not that would work the same in an osteoarthritic population or, you know, just a healthy population that with regular wear and tear. I know with OA, a lot of companies don't want to look at that because they don't want to make any kind of claims for, you know, diseases. And
are there sex differences in the incidence of osteoarthritis? And also, are there sex differences perhaps in how men and women respond to collagen?
I think there are. We did see some sex differences in our study. I think that we need to have more power to actually look at it definitively. In OA, there is a higher prevalence in females, especially around that menopause age. And then I know, especially in knee OA, females have a much higher prevalence of it. And then they end up getting more of those total knee arthroplasty surgeries. Aside from that, I think like with hips and things like that, I think it's pretty 50-50.
Because you had mentioned doing a study in postmenopausal women. So what was the need there? I guess just because they are the ones that are going to experience some of that bone loss due to their age and going through menopause.
Yeah, I think the estrogen, the decrease in estrogen is going to have a high impact, especially on the knee. And so I think I want to explore that a little bit more. What we're planning now is we're going to look at males and females, but we're only going to look at an age group that would be postmenopausal. So all females in that age group are going to have to be postmenopausal. And we're going to supplement them for 2 months prior to going through surgery. Then we're going to collect all the tissue from their knee, synovial fluid, ACL, PCL, bone, muscle, skin. And then they're going to continue to supplement for 4 months post-op. And they're also going to take deuterium and things like that. So we can look at, you know, incorporation of deuterium into all that tissue as well. And then look at mRNA and proteomics. So just throw everything at it to be able to measure true turnover and whether or not, you know, consuming a supplement versus taking a placebo is actually mechanistically going to impact any of that. And so I'm hoping that we'll actually be able to get at some of that question with postmenopause. And some of the sex difference questions. And then we can start looking at premenopausal and postmenopausal after that, hopefully.
Okay, so bottom line, your advice, who should be taking collagen? Should it be at any age? Should it be when you get old like me? Does it matter if you're a mother or not a mother? I mean, tell us what you think.
My opinion is that I would recommend taking it. I would recommend taking maybe 5 to 10 grams. I take it every morning with my whey and just get it out of the way. I think, you know, there's a lot of studies that support its effects on not just joints, but skin health. And as a woman, I want to try to stay as wrinkle-free as long as possible.
I was going to ask you about that.
Wait, does it actually do that? I have no idea.
Yes, collagen production in the face like drastically decreases as you get older. And from what I understand, ingesting collagen is actually better sometimes than the topical, or maybe it's vice versa for the skin.
No, ingesting it. Yeah, because they haven't found any kind of peptides that they can actually, that can penetrate topically. So they all have to be consumed. And the studies have shown that it improves hydration, elasticity, and collagen content in skin. And then there's just a new study that just came out in July for burns and wound healing. So that's something else that we're looking at with the scarring from the TKA is the skin. How is the wound healing with supplementation? So I have to say, like, my hair, it grows really long. And so all I can say is, you know, the worst side effects I have is that I might have better skin and better hair. So
maybe you should take that for better hair.
My you know, skin talking, Guillermo made that same joke, actually. He was like, oh, maybe I need some collagen.
Hey, I'll try anything, you know. No, actually, I've gotten so used to it now. I can drive with my windows down. I don't have to worry about my hair flying around. Like you, Cassie, your hair's like going, it's all over the place, you know.
No convertible driving.
Well, actually, that's probably why most people would want to take it. If it makes your hair and skin look better, who cares about your joints? Hey, I want pretty skin, right? I mean,
you mentioned like different sports, and I know you were looking at like recreational athletes, and obviously triathletes tend to have more like endurance style exercise compared to maybe CrossFit. Like, is there anything to suggest that like maybe a endurance athlete is better suited for taking the collagen supplement versus someone that, I don't know what we would categorize CrossFit as, but maybe a power lifter or.
Strength power athlete. Yeah.
I don't know. I think maybe the more frequently you exercise might be a good indicator of how well it might work for you, just because of what I saw from dichotomizing the exercise frequency groups. I don't know if the intensity of it makes a difference or not. I did look at those numbers when I looked at vigorous versus low to moderate, and I didn't see any kind of differences when I looked at vigorous exercise or resistance training versus aerobic. But I did see just low to moderate exercise frequency was what really kind of started to show differences between the groups. But that was just in our study. So I really can't speak to how it would be in another population. But I just think if people are moving and they're getting that impact and they're kind of stimulating some of that turnover already, and then they're getting the building blocks and increased signaling to those areas for enhanced, you know, joint recovery, then that's going to be beneficial for them. So
will any collagen supplement work? Like I know like Whole Foods, for instance, sells like a fancy vanilla flavory one, or, you know, like, is there a specific kind or reputable brand? Or like, if I, as your average consumer, I'm going to the store and looking for one, like, what are some things that I should pay attention for?
I just always tell people, make sure it's third-party tested. And that's all I can say. I don't know all the brands that are out there. A lot of the brands get formulations from the bigger kind of companies that are the ones that are actually funding the research. And then they make their own kind of combinations of them. I know what's popular out there. I know what I use. I don't know if I should drop brand names or not. You guys can tell
me. Sure, go ahead, drop them.
I mean, I use Vital Proteins. It's easy. It's easy to find. I have a relationship with them. And then also they do use one of the companies they use is the supplier that funded our research previously, but they also use a bunch of other ones out of Europe also. So, and they seem reputable and they're third party tested, but I mean, I always say like, look at what looks affordable, what seems, you know, appropriate. I think they should all be relatively the same unless they're starting to make claims that they're formulated specifically for X, Y, and Z, you know? So for instance, marine collagen is supposed to be better for, you know, the skin. So maybe if you're really looking for it for anti-wrinkle, anti-aging, maybe look at like a marine collagen. But I think, you know, none of that has really been tested and none of them have been compared. So we're still kind of questioning whether does it matter what the source is, if it's all formulated into the same type of, you know, peptides or not.
So is the marine, because I wonder if the other advantage or not advantage, but like a take sometimes that food companies will do is to, because obviously collagen is an animal product. So vegetarians are missing out on the awesome benefits of it, but sometimes they'll say something's marine, like a marine collagen and hope to kind of get it. So is it coming from fish? Is it coming from something?
Yeah, it's coming from fish. Yeah. So yeah, and that's a good point too. They're increasing, you know, their population of people that might be willing to buy it. So I know that, for instance, you know, collagen made out of pig is not very popular in the United States, whereas in other countries it's more popular just because people aren't as apt to buy it here. So bovine collagen here is pretty popular because nobody has an issue with the beef products. And so the marine might be more popular in places where people don't eat pork or beef.
Is pig ear collagen?
Pig ear? Yeah.
Pig ears.
Okay. Yeah. I wouldn't suggest eating it though. I don't know if it's human grade.
Well, no, I think, I swear to God, it's a Filipino dish. Because we eat pretty much every part of the pig.
Yeah.
I think the hoof is even included in some of the dishes. So
maybe that's one of the arguments actually as to why we should be supplementing with collagen peptides is because our ancestors used to have diets that contained collagen. And now in the Western diet, especially, we're no longer eating foods that contain collagen. And so, you know, like, you know, beef broth and all those things kind of made a comeback, like, you know, in the last 10 years. And so that's kind of a source, but that's native collagen and it's still not as effective at increasing those peptides and amino acids like glycine and proline and hydroxyproline in the blood. But still, I mean, you know, if you have that naturally in your diet and you're consuming all those amino acids, then you're getting the building blocks at least. But most of us aren't consuming dishes like that anymore.
Yeah. Doesn't skin have high levels of collagen? Do you eat skin? No. Cassie,
do you eat skin? I do. I got a rotisserie chicken. I'm going to eat the skin. Like
pig skin. You ever had pig skin?
Isn't that not chicharrones? What's the other one?
It's lechon. It's called lechon.
There's like the fried ones, aren't they? Like there's pig skin. Is that what
Those pork rinds.
Yeah, pork rinds. Yeah. Yeah, I've had pork rinds before. I mean, if you look at it from, I know this is very popular right now in the food industry, but from like a waste or trying not to waste aspect of it, I mean, people should get on board with using every aspect of the pig because it does supply a lot of great nutrients. And now we know collagen. And
yep.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I'll make sure I eat more pig skin because I love pig skin, especially when it's freshly cooked. I know you guys don't eat pig skin, but if you ever go to a Filipino barbecue and they're cooking the pig lechon, if you cut off the skin, it's like the most delicious part. There's a lot of fat too. If you like fat, I like fat and salt, you know, so I'm not a sweet person. You know, people are like, I crave sweets. I'm like, I crave fat and salt. Give me fat.
Yeah. I'm a savory person also. Like, yeah. Umami.
Okay. So from now on, I need to start at least 5 grams a day of collagen, just to see what it does.
Yeah.
I'll be curious to see if I look 3 months younger. So that by itself would be worth it. So so tell us a little bit about some other projects you have going on, University of Arkansas Medical Center.
Okay. Yeah. So I think I mentioned earlier that I just finished a proteomic study on ACL, collecting ACLs from people with osteoarthritis that went through total knee arthroplasty surgery. And we're characterizing their proteomic profile, and then we're comparing it to healthy samples. So they have a company out here called Aurora that they do organ donations and tissue donations from people that qualify. And so I was on call for several months. 2 a.m. usually is about the time they give me a call, and they tell me that they had somebody that died in an accident or from natural causes that meets criteria, and I'd go in there and collect their tissue. So it's currently being analyzed, and we're going to use these profiles basically to then set up the next study and see what we can do as a targeted analysis. So the next study is that we're going to give collagen to people going through TKA surgery, as I mentioned earlier, placebo versus supplement group, total of 6 months, 2 months prior to surgery, 4 months after, and look at how the collagen supplementation prior to surgery impacts collagen turnover, signaling, mRNA, and then also then the recovery measures of post-surgery. So we'll look at movement screens, we'll look at all the same survey measures, we'll look at mood, their feeling throughout the recovery process, and we'll look at wound healing of the incision site, which is usually really large. It's a pretty gnarly surgery. I don't know if either of you have had the opportunity to be in the OR watching that thing, but yeah, it's amazing that these people, but it improves their quality of life because a lot of them just can't really do anything else until they get that surgery. And a lot of them are in there for both knees, you know, like, yeah.
Right. How old are these people typically?
I mean, it ranges. So again, genetically gifted. I know runners who can run till they're 90 and do 100 miles a week. And I know people that can run 10 miles a week for, you know, 5 years and their knees are gone. So there are a lot of athletes. There are a lot of people that are obese, a lot of people that are sedentary. They kind of run the gambit. For this study, we're going to do, I think, 50 to 70, just so that we can kind of normalize our hormone profiles also. We'll see what happens with that. And that should be kind of a landmark study for future studies, hopefully. And so we'll be able to look at, you know, how is the bone incorporating some of that collagen peptide? How is the ACL versus the PCL? ACL doesn't really get a lot of blood flow. PCL does. So is there a difference in both of those ligaments in their incorporation of it? Is synovial fluid, is inflammation down? This is going to be a disease population, so osteoarthritis. So basically won't be able to necessarily say that this applies to everyone that doesn't have osteoarthritis, but it's a good start because I think the efficacy of collagen is questioned a lot. And I think that once we have some kind of mechanistic data out there in humans, it would be a good way to kind of lay the foundation as to whether or not this actually is doing something. So
not related to like the actual study itself, but just kind of the collection part, if you can back up a little bit, because I was just curious, because you mentioned you were on call. And so would they actually hand you the tissue or were you working with the cadavers yourself?
I would go into the OR where they were processing the cadavers. So they're okay. Harvesting all the tissue. And I don't know if people know that this happens, but some people that are willing to, you know, donate their organs also donate their tissue to companies that then make prosthetics. They make all kinds of, devices or products that are biologics that can go and be used for other people that, you know, for burn victims, for people that are getting, they're taking out veins, they're taking all kinds of tendons and ligaments and synovial fluid, and they're taking bones. And so they would basically remove all the skin, they'd send it to different processors, they would kind of break the bones off and then put them into different bags and send them to different processors. And then when they got to the knees, they would ask me to kind of tell them which ACLs I wanted. And then we would kind of, then I'd just take them with me and process them however I needed to process them. Right. So it was a lot of dead bodies. It took a little bit of getting used to, especially hearing the snapping of the bones.
Ouch. Like
a little queasy once, and then after that I was fine, but yeah.
Yeah, when I was in grad school at University of Texas Medical Center, I actually, on your driver's license, you could check off if you want to be part of the willed body program. So once you die, you actually have to call the university and they actually pick up your body and they embalm you, they do whatever, and they use you for gross anatomy class or whatever. What's funny is now as I've gotten older, I don't check off the box anymore. I'm like, you know what? I think I'll keep my body. I don't need medical students to be chopping it up or whatever.
To the body farm. You know, they have that body farm where like they like examine like the different rates of like decomposition.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. That's where I want to end.
PSI, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think
I'm still an organ donor. I think, but I don't know about body farms or,
What was the other, God, there was another question I had about that. I'm blanking now. Cassie, if you have a question, go on. I got stuck on the willed body program.
I can relate to the cadaver thing because a couple summers ago I was part of, I guess technically I was an employee, but we were doing cadaver dissections at Nova, and it's just a really surreal experience, but that's why I was asking, like, if you were actually like in there with them. And it is really neat to learn. I knew that you can dedicate or donate your body to science, but I didn't realize that they use so much more than just the organs, you know, having the opportunity, like in your case, to use it for your study or like the bones and the veins is, I find it heartwarming, but.
Yeah, it is. And so, I mean, I don't know if you realize, so if they are organ donors and they're still alive and they're able, so they have to still have like, I think a beating heart, or they have to be able to keep them alive while they're harvesting those organs. But otherwise they can still at least donate that tissue, even if they can't donate the organs. So, I mean, the family signs off on it. And then as long as they qualify and they don't have any kind of major diseases or anything like that. It's something I was all new to me. I had no idea. I was just one day I was walking into lunch and it seems really morbid. Well, and you know, David and Arnie and I eat lunch together almost every single day. And I was just like, how do I get a healthy sample? How do I get a healthy sample? Nobody's going to let me take out their ACL. And I was like, I wonder if organ donors. And so I walked in, I was like, what if I get it from dead bodies? And they just stopped eating or just like, not this again.
Oh yeah. Okay. That jogged my memory. No, when I was in grad school, I was trying to get muscle tissue from just random people. I ended up calling the coroner of Parkland Hospital. They call it the Knife and Gun Club. And I said, hey, this is an odd request, but when a new body comes in, can I come in and take muscle samples? And he's like, sure. It seems so nonchalant. So I would go down there on a Monday because on Friday, Saturday, Sunday, there would always be people killed, like literally Knife and Gun Club. A lot of young bodies. It was really kind of depressing. You see young bodies like 18-year-olds, 20-year-olds. I'm like, holy crap. And I would take deltoid tissue, like, you know, vastus lateralis, tib anterior. I was looking at androgen receptor content, but just like you, you sort of think of like, how can I do this? I can't get all these volunteers to give tissue. Oh, wait a minute. I do have volunteers. They're not signing a consent form, but you know, it all works out in the end.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's how you think outside the box, and there's always a solution.
And they're serving as your healthy control.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So they couldn't have any osteoarthritis, and it's amazing because the tissue looks completely different.
Really?
I've been doing tissue histology, and like you can tell right away which group they're in. The color of the tissue, especially when we went to pulverize them to go and try to, it's really fibrous. So like we're trying to pulverize them after they've been snap frozen so that I could send like small pieces to proteomics. And it's like, it looks like shredded chicken, you know, like it's really dry, it's really fibrous, but like the OA stuff is just super bloody and it's just like red and nasty and angry looking. And like the ones from the healthy samples are just like pristine, beautiful, just white, like cords, all intact. And yeah, the people are walking around with no ACLs, by the way. Like I would say 50% of the surgeries I went into that I consented people for didn't have anything to even take out.
Wow.
Yeah. So that was also something I learned. And the surgeons were generally pretty surprised too, that they're like, sorry, there's nothing that we can give you from this sample. So, you know, it was like, took a long time to get the disease samples.
So and that's been like deterioration over the years of.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, they're really interested in this study also because, you know, it's a question of like, how much do you need an ACL? Like, do people need to go into ACL reconstructive surgeries when they have a tear, or, you know, is there potential for self-healing one too? Like if you're not an athlete and you're just an average person, like, do you really need to go in and like do all this stuff, or like, you know, cause most of them are walking around without one. So
if you're walking around without an ACL, are there better sports or activities that you can do? I mean, if you like to exercise, you know, like for instance, running versus cycling versus swimming, I would imagine swimming. I'm just guessing. I don't know. If you don't have an ACL, it's not such a bad thing. Running, it could be a bad thing.
I'm not sure. So, I mean, I know from looking at all of the x-rays, I mean, one of the ways I was trying to determine whether or not somebody had an intact ACL was to see how forward or back their tibia was. So I know that the ACL is kind of what fixes that in place and keeps, you know, the kind of ball and socket there with the femur. So I would think that anything that's lateral might be better, but I could be completely wrong here. And anything that's like kind of, you know, forward motion might actually be bad because you don't have that stability of holding that joint in place. So, but I don't know. That's something that, you know, I think they also want to look at. So we have a new sports med doctor starting, I think, next summer here. And I think he's really interested in looking and asking some of those questions also. So maybe we'll figure that out.
I have some fun, goofy questions, Cassie, if you don't mind.
No. I like things.
Shai, you're going to tell us your training program and your supplement program.
Okay.
First training. I want to know, are you training for anything, or do you just like doing random exercise like all the CrossFit people down the street?
Oh, no. I'm always, I always say I'm training for life. So my philosophy is I want to be able to get up and do anything, anytime, anywhere, and be fit enough to do it, right? So perfect example, my sister several years ago, I had just had my daughter, I think a year and a half before that. She was doing her residency at OHSU up in Portland. And she was like, hey, you want to go climb Mount St. Helen? It's February, it's full of snow. I said, sure. And so didn't know what we were doing, went with another resident friend of hers and some guy that pretended that he had a clue about mountaineering. And we got our packs. I watched a YouTube video on how to, like, you know, use the ice axe to break on my way down. And we hiked up that sucker. I have pictures of like us with like snow pack everywhere, nothing, no footsteps anywhere in sight. We made it to the top, luckily. But like 100 feet from the top. And my sister had been doing a lot of hiking. She like gassed out. And so we chucked her pack. I took whatever she needed and threw it in my pack and basically helped her up to the top. And then hiked back down. And I was just like, see, this is what I trained for. This is so I can do crap like this on the fly, like no problem. and then, you know, make sure I can cover for my people that are, that can't make it.
Wait, total, how long did that take? Because I know Cassie's big into hiking. She did the Grand Canyon, you know, rim to rim. And
I want to do that. I've only gone down to the bottom and up. I think it took us like 15 hours.
Yeah, that was, so Whitney was like that for me a little bit. Like, first off, I won the first time I ever signed up for the lotto, I got the permit for it. I got the, and I did it for like 8 people. And then I'm like, I don't even know 8 people that hike. and I'm in Florida, you know? Yeah. So, and it was right around COVID. So like I had a bunch of people that were going to go with me. And at the last minute, nobody went. Someone got sick. And I had some random girl that was a friend of someone else's friend that like said they were interested. I said, well, I'm going to be here on this day in California. If you show up, come hike with me. And I remember I showed up the day before at the base of the mountain, just to kind of like check things out. And there was this guy, Crazy Jack, and he was like summiting Mount Whitney for like the 200th time. And he's like, you know, have you acclimated? I said, well, I arrived from Florida this morning, so no, you know. And, and I think Whitney took me about like 15 or 16 hours. And same thing, that last, I was doing really well. And then that last mile, I made it to the top, but like we got to the top and the other girl did show up. And I remember I told her, I said, I'm going to go back down. You take your time and enjoy it up here, but I got to get lower. And then the fun fact is, so it took me, like I said, I think 15, 16 hours. It took Crazy Jack like less than 9, and he did it in like a t-shirt and his, oh, and I asked him like his like go-to snack. And he said, Mike and Ike's. So.
Wait, what is that? What?
Mike and Ike's. You can Google, you can actually Google Crazy Jack.
I bet.
Yeah. So,
well, but yeah, like, was like that too. There are people that were hiking up with their skis and their snowboards. And then they would like get up to the top and then they would bomb down.
So crazy, isn't it?
And there's like avalanche people out there, like checking out for avalanches. Like it was just, I was like, that's on my bucket list now. I'm going to snowboard down one of these giant mountains, but not, it hasn't happened yet.
That's cool. So what about water sports? You said you surf.
Yeah, well, I used to when I lived in a place that I can. I have a stand-up paddle board here, and I kayak when I can, but I actually am dedicated to tennis at the moment. So I play tennis every day almost.
Pickleball?
No, pickleball's fun, but I think that's like an adjunct to like maybe working on my net game. Yeah, but I am kind of psycho about tennis right now. So I play as much as I can. Some days I'll hit for 3 hours if I can find enough people to hit with me. But
you play like pairs or singles or?
I play singles, which is weird because I am 42 and most people my age don't want to play singles anymore. So yeah, trying to.
You're sounding prematurely old.
Yeah, like what's happening? Oh, no, yeah. But yeah, I'm kind of dedicated to getting, higher rated and I'm playing in a lot of tournaments and a lot of leagues, but I also cross train. I try to cross train at least once a day with something else. So I've been cycling a lot here, like 15 to 25 miles and then running and weight training, yoga, basically anything I can do.
A little of everything.
Yeah. I used to be a rock climber when I was back in California, so I don't really do that anymore, but I might start because they have a community here. So I kind of, adjust to where I'm living. In Florida, I was jumping horses a lot because I couldn't surf or rock climb. So, you know, you got to find stuff that makes you happy and gets your adrenaline pumping just a little bit enough so you feel alive still while you're working.
Well, one of these days you'll have to go paddling with Cassie and I. We go paddling the Atlantic Ocean, basically, I guess, or the intercoastal.
Yeah, and the next time I do a crazy hiking trip, like a long one, I'll call you because it's really hard to find people that want to do these like kind of endurance style, like, you know, the rim to rim hike, the Grand Canyon, doing that in one day, like it's hard to find people that are willing to find joy. And
yeah, no, that was fun. That was way more intense than I expected going down to Grand Canyon. I was like, this is steep.
Yeah.
No, I would totally do it. And you know, we're at the base of the Ozarks here. So we have incredible hiking here. Everybody is like, and waterfalls for days, like every single place, there's books and books on waterfalls to see in Arkansas. So definitely, if you ever want to venture out this way, please do. I have an extra room too. So,
well, super cool.
What are some of the supplements then that you're taking to kind of also prep you for life?
Yes. Yeah, well, definitely collagen. I do supplement a lot with protein, whey, just because I can't eat enough food that it's going to have enough protein for me. And I try to kind of make sure that I'm getting a lot every day. I take vitamin C. I take multi. I take 10,000 IUs of vitamin D every day. My doctor actually said that I have the highest serum levels he's ever seen in a person.
No way. What is it?
It was like one something, like 110 maybe.
Wait, and that's not from sun exposure.
No.
Holy geez. That's crazy. I don't know anyone who's ever had it that high.
Well, then I tried to decrease it and I felt like crap. So I said, forget this. I'm going to take it. I'm just going to keep taking it because I don't have any adverse events. So yeah, I take calcium and then just normal stuff, magnesium, biotin. I think that's about it right now.
Caffeine.
Oh, I'm a caffeine junkie.
Yeah. People always forget caffeine because it's sort of a normal part of your day, like coffee, caffeine.
It is. Yeah. And I'm addicted to monsters. So I'm not going to lie.
You mentioned, well, obviously you're taking vitamin C, but I think you mentioned earlier in the podcast that vitamin C, there's some sort of relationship to collagen. So can you not be deficient in vitamin C? Is it helping with the uptake of it?
So I mentioned glycine proline and hydroxyproline. Those are the three main amino acids that kind of are continuous repeats throughout, especially type 1 collagen. And we need vitamin C for the hydroxylation of proline to hydroxyproline. And so if you have poor vitamin C status, or even I think there's a study out there that had people fasted and they didn't see the same results. And then they looked at their serum vitamin C and saw that it was pretty low. Cause I mean, if you don't have like excessive intake, like first thing in the morning, if you haven't eaten for 8 to 12 hours, you might have pretty low vitamin C and you need it for everything. So you might not have as much ability to do that hydroxylation process if you don't have adequate status, right? So I just kind of take an emergency packet and put it in my pre-workout in the morning. And that way I kind of take care of it. And then have my collagen after that, and then I'm good to go. So.
Awesome. Well, hey, we're out of time. I want to, first of all, thank you for being on the show. Let the audience know where, if they want more information on you or where they would expect to see any new research or publications. Are you giving any talks anywhere, or are you just, you know, enjoying the hidden gem of Arkansas?
I don't have any talks scheduled, actually. This is the last podcast I've been scheduled for a while. I do have an Instagram account, Shaloa Kvitkovsky. You can just search me and you'll find me.
It's so easy to spell.
Yeah, exactly. I need to come up with a better handle, I think. But yeah, definitely another, I mean, you know, JSSN is going to be publishing that article. And then there's going to be at least one more, hopefully coming out this year, and then tons next year. So definitely keep an eye out for that.
Okay. Well, this has been fun.
Thank you.
Now I know you are the Renaissance woman of like activity. So if we need random people to do strange athletic things, we're calling you, Shai. We're calling you.
I'm in for anything.
All right. Well, hey, thanks for being on Sports Science News. I want to thank Cassie for filling in for Dr. Tony Ricci. And I'll have the podcast uploaded probably in a day or two. So thanks again, Shai. Appreciate you being on.
Thanks, everyone.
All right. Bye-bye.